Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann here with Medical Monday. Today on the program, we talk with Jacqueline Cosgrove, health reporter for the Oklahoman, which is the largest circulation newspaper in the state. Cosgrove is the recipient of a Rosalind Carter Fellowship in Mental Health Journalism, only the second Oklahoman ever to receive the honor. The award stipend allows her to travel to other states to do comparative analyses of programming and treatment and see how other states prioritize care for those afflicted with mental illness. Her journey so far has led her to many different archives, and she's published a number of feature stories on various mental health topics under the rubric Epidemic Ignored. Her first, from this past January, was a wide-ranging history of Oklahoma's mental health system from pre-statehood onward. You may not be surprised, but mental health treatment has been chronically underfunded relative to the need and to the amount of investment that other states make. But there are some positive aspects to this history, including very early adoption of the idea of community mental health treatment, keeping people with mental illness in their home communities rather than institutionalized and providing treatment to them locally. Jacqueline Cosgrove, health reporter for the Oklahoman, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Jacqueline Cosgrove, welcome to Studio Tulsa. I want to start by asking you about your series called Epidemic Ignored in the Oklahoman, and you've really decided to take on this issue of the mental health care system such as it is in Oklahoma. And the first big piece was titled Epidemic Ignored, Oklahoma Treats Its Mental Health System Without Care. It was pretty exhaustive. I was impressed by the level of research you put into this. I mean, it was almost like you wrote a college term paper or something on the history of mental health treatment in Oklahoma. So, I mean, I guess give us the broad brushstrokes, if you can, in sort of a short capsule.
Sure. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me here, and thank you for the kind words about the piece. I decided to do this piece first for the project because I felt like people kind of needed to know a history of the system, and I wanted to know a history of the system. I had heard Commissioner Terry White of the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services talk about how Oklahoma had underfunded its mental health system for decades, and I wanted to know if that was true. I wanted to know if there were any bright spots or if there were points where we were doing well. So I just decided I'm going to go back as far as I think relevant. And then I stumbled upon something from 1895 where the territorial governor was talking about our mental health system. And at that time, before Oklahoma was a state, we were sending our residents with mental illnesses to Illinois. And he decided that it was too expensive, which is funny when you think about the conversations we're now having about the mental health system. And so he decided that they should be treated in their communities, which I thought was really interesting, considering that several years later, you know, we had the community mental health movement.
That was not until the 1960s, so this was well ahead of its
right.
time.
Right, absolutely.
Governor William Renfro of Oklahoma Territory.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, and then I ended up finding a report from 1937 where they talked about, essentially they said that whatever the future may bring, Oklahoma cannot look upon itself with pride until it cares for, essentially they said, its residents with mental illnesses. And that was in 1937.
So this was during the Depression.
Right. And that was a big report where a bunch of physicians had gotten together and studied our mental health system. So yeah, in looking at the system since before statehood, what I found is Oklahoma has never truly invested in its mental health system and made a sustainable effort to fund its mental health system.
So you started with pre-statehood, and we were literally shipping off people with serious mental illness to another state. And then later, Governor Renshaw decided we shouldn't do that, A, because arguably it was too costly, and then B, maybe because it was inhumane and we could treat people in their own communities. So what happened then? We started to do what a lot of most states did, and that we opened up some state facilities, right? State-run hospitals.
Yeah, we started using a private facility in Norman, which is now Griffin Memorial Hospital and is a state-run facility. At that time, it was a private hospital. And so that was essentially the birth of the mental health system in Oklahoma. And then over the years, we opened up Eastern State in Bonita, and we opened up Western State in Fort Supply. And I think those two locations are very interesting because they're so far away. And I've always seen that as an out of sight, out of mind situation.
Wow. And didn't the one in Bonita ultimately close?
Yes. And the one in Fort Supply closed as the institution itself.
The institution shut down, you mean?
Well, part of it was turned into a prison, which is interesting. And there's still a community health center in that area that kind of spun off of Western State closing. And then Eastern State, now the buildings are still there. And then if you look to the basically next to the building, there's the Oklahoma Forensic Center where they do competency evaluations and where people who are sentenced to not guilty by reason of insanity, they stay there and receive treatment. They have about 200 beds at that facility.
So one thing that your reporting has taught me, I had a perception that perhaps in the sort of the glorified old days, even when we had state institutions and people were institutionalized, that somehow there was always like enough capacity And, you know, nowadays where we struggle to find beds for those that are acutely mentally ill or in need of a crisis bed, and it's always hard in the emergency departments and finding beds across the state. But that really isn't the case from your reporting. I mean, these hospitals, these state institutions, whether they were at first private and eventually became state hospitals, were overcrowded almost from the get-go.
No, absolutely. What was interesting when I was doing the research on this, I found an investigation that the Oklahoman did years ago. Mike Gorman was an investigative journalist at the Oklahoman. And in the 1940s, he wrote several articles. And what he found was just, you know, these hospitals were just jam-packed with people. And from reading his investigation and reading about that time, we painted with a pretty broad brush of who ended up at those hospitals. I mean, you had people with developmental delays who didn't necessarily have a mental illness. You had people who had a varying specter of mental illnesses. And then, you know, you also had hospitals treating people for, you know, vitamin deficiencies and venereal disease and things that typically now you wouldn't see get so serious that they cause a mental health issue.
Right. I was, I guess, surprised by that. But we're looking at medical history, which is just chock full of sort of those things. And of course, now with antibiotics, luckily we can treat venereal diseases. So we talked a little bit about the Community Mental Health Act in the early to mid-1960s, and so that's when our larger institutions were, in a sense, depopulated. And of course, the biggest trend we've seen, and this really is across the nation, not just in Oklahoma, is that when we let people out of state-run institutions, typically that's what we attribute sort of the homeless problem to, the homeless problem in America. And then, of course, we've traded essentially, right, state institutions and mental hospitals for really jail and the prison system.
No, absolutely. I mean, Justin Jones, who is the former Oklahoma Department of Corrections director, he had a chart that he would show the legislature, and it was a big X, and it showed the declining population in our state psychiatric institutions and the, you know, increasing population of offenders who needed to take, antipsychotic medication and who had mental illnesses. And it's just incredibly startling to me when you look at that population. You know, 57% of the Oklahoma Department of Corrections populations, that's a little more than 16,500 people, either have current symptoms of mental illness or have a history of mental illness.
Wow. And like in the days of yesteryear with the state hospitals, one thing your reporting taught me is that it wasn't like these folks were getting treatment. I mean, they were essentially warehoused. I mean, they were just sort of having a place to sleep. They were getting fed. They were doing chores. But they were very few of them, if any, getting treatment, psychological, psychiatric treatment. And at least we now have requirement essentially by law to provide health care. But is your in your reporting, what have you found about folks in the prison system that have mental illness?
Well, interestingly enough, about 3 weeks ago, I spent 3 days alongside the mental health staff at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAllister. That's our maximum security facility. And so I followed the staff around for 3 days and just saw what they did. And some people might be surprised to know they have a mental health staff, but they are constitutionally required, DOC is, to provide mental health care. And so it was really interesting to me. I mean, the staff there, and I'll be writing about this for a story probably that'll run later this month, they all really, really cared about what they were doing. And they knew the offenders very well. And they are essentially doing the best they can working within the parameters that they have to. So yeah, it was just interesting to spend 3 days with them. You know, I followed around Dr. Patty Stem, she's a psychologist who is the clinical director there at McAllister. And at one point, you know, she was in the midst of an emergency where an offender had taken what they thought was probably bath salts, which is a mixture of meth and PCP, kind of like, not literally, but that's sort of what it's like. And I mean, so many of the guards and the nurses got blood and spit thrown on them because the offender was just freaking out, you know, because he was hallucinating so heavily. And that just happened. I mean, everything was normal and then it wasn't. And so I just saw a lot of people really trying to do their best. I'm not saying that I think our prison system's perfect by any means, but I do think there are people there who do care.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann. It's Medical Monday. My guest today is Jacqueline Cosgrove, who's a health reporter at the Oklahoman. She's also the recipient of a Rosalind Carter Mental Health Journalism Fellowship. And Jacqueline Cosgrove, you've done some amazing reporting about mental health in Oklahoma. And
thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your fellowship. That's from the Carter Center, Atlanta.
Yes. 6 U.S. journalists and then a few journalists from another country. This year it was Colombia. We all have a fellowship to do different projects. So my project is focused on low-income, uninsured Oklahomans, largely adults, who are diagnosed with mental illnesses and substance use disorders, and just looking at the barriers they face to treatment. You know, like, for example, the current waiting line for residential substance abuse care in Oklahoma is 600 people long. And you're put at priority if you're a pregnant woman or an IV drug user or both. But otherwise, you are in a very long waiting line. And so I wanted to look at the folks who are in those waiting lines who can't get the care they need to treat their brain diseases. And so that has been the focus of my project. The other part of my project, which I'll be starting very soon, and I've traveled a little bit, but part of it is traveling to other states and looking at their mental health systems, different components of it. So I went to Georgia and looked at the changes they've made. They were under a consent order, basically, where they were mandated by the federal government to make changes to their mental health system. It also related to people with developmental disabilities. But I wanted to see what it was like for a state that funds mental health similarly to Oklahoma and is also in the South, what it was like for when a state was forced by the federal government to spend more money on its mental health system. And what I found there were that mental health advocates are actually optimistic about where Georgia's going with the changes they've made under that forced order.
Well, that's interesting. So it was a consent order, as you said, or consent decree, and they were forced by the federal government or the judicial system to essentially budget more money out of their state legislative process to the mental health system. And were there requirements as to how the money was spent, or what did the government decide sort of for the state how to do it, or it was a matter of letting their state department for mental health handle the services, or do you not have it at that level yet?
Well, I am working on it. I'm hoping to have that story by the end of my fellowship in September. But the way I understand it is it was all agreed upon by everybody kind of in the federal government, state officials, advocates. NAMI Georgia was very involved. You know, Georgia has a very strong peer support network. And so it was interesting. I mean, they really beefed up their crisis system. You know, we have crisis centers here in Oklahoma, but one of the things in Georgia that they have is this place where you can stay when you get out of the hospital for like a crisis. Someone can stay in these apartments for up to 60 days, and it's really intensive case management. And it's to make sure that they don't just go right back into another crisis.
This is like transitional housing, essentially.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They may not. Is it required to do so once you're released, or is it that they don't have another home to go to, perhaps?
I don't believe it's required, but it's just to help ensure that the folks, and these are adults we're talking about, are able to transition a little more smoothly rather than just being sent to a homeless shelter, for example, which happens often. And then the other states I plan to go to, I'm hoping to go to Texas and look at some of the efforts they've made to keep people from going to jail by getting the police more involved. There's a mental health unit in San Antonio that I'll be looking at. And then I'm hoping to go to Arkansas also and look at the impact that Medicaid expansion has had on adults with mental illnesses now having coverage, what that's looked like.
Wow. Excellent. So let's look a little bit at numbers. So we just finished a legislative session here in Oklahoma, and you had to sort of take time out from your fellowship. You were telling me to cover really the state appropriation process and as far as the health system, because you're an overall health reporter, but it's specifically as it applies to mental health as well. What happened to health care in this legislative cycle here in Oklahoma?
In terms of mental health, so the Department of Health had a budget of about $340 million, and then we had the revenue shortfall. And so their budget was, they had to take money out, about $23 million in services, which means they had to cut services. They had to cut, for example, the amount of therapy that people can get. And so their budget was knocked down to $317 million. And once the next fiscal year budget was put out, it was shown that the Department of Health was going to get $324 million, which I apologize to your listeners in the car right now for making them do math, but that was only about $7 million when their leaders were anticipating they would get $30 million and bump them back up to that $340 million, so they would at least be back to where they were before the budget crisis.
So overall, they're cut way down over a year, a significant decrement, although technically speaking, because of the funny math and the revenue failure, they're slightly up kind of at the end of the year from where they were wind up being in the actual fiscal year 2016.
Right, with the revenue shortfall.
About a 2% rate increase or something like that.
Yeah.
So let's look at further numbers. Your reporting has shown not only it's the humane thing to do to treat folks with mental illness in terms of an investment sort of in our fellow brothers and sisters, but also it makes sound economic sense. For example, so how much does it cost to incarcerate someone for a year?
Someone with a serious mental illness, it costs about $23,000 a year.
And then if we're able to provide treatment, like as an outpatient, where someone wouldn't necessarily, a nonviolent offender could be steered clear of prison, or, you know, jail and or prison, what are the costs there?
Yeah, so if you're talking about someone who's just an adult seeking care through the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, and they haven't gotten in trouble yet, they could get services for a little more than $2,000 for a year.
So this is essentially a tenfold difference.
Yes.
But you have some other associated costs there. So let's see what else.
So one of the diversion programs we have in Oklahoma, diversion programs are essentially where you have somebody who has been arrested for a crime and it's acknowledged that they have a mental health issue or a substance abuse issue. And so instead of sending them to jail and sending them on to prison, if they're convicted, diversion programs take them from prison and put them into a program. And so we have a few different types, but two of the main ones are mental health court and drug court. Mental health court is about $5,400 a year, and drug court is about $5,000.
But these are per individual cost, per capita cost. Okay.
Yes, but we're still talking about $23,000.
Exactly.
So, but one of the hard things about mental health court is it's only in about 16 counties, but we have 77 counties. So the thing is you and another person could have the same diagnosis, commit the same crime, but you live in different counties. One of you goes to mental health court, one of you goes to prison.
Wow. So I'm surprised there hasn't been sort of a class action suit or something brought to try to force, like that seems like unequal treatment under the law, you know, that type of a thing. But I guess that's for lawyers to figure out.
Right, and mental health advocates.
One of your other pieces in Epidemic Ignored, the series that you're writing in a year long as part of your fellowship for the Oklahoman, was called There Has to Be a Better Solution. And in that, you focus on 21-year-old Justice Skylar Cobbs, or Skylar as he, I guess, is called by his family. And Skylar has had, just suffice it to say, a pretty awful life. But he is someone who's caught up in the system and really doesn't have the resources to fight through it. I mean, I guess, can you tell us a little bit about Skylar and his life story?
Sure. I was looking for someone in prison who pretty much no one could argue belonged there. And so that's why I decided to focus on Skylar, because, you know, he has developmental delays. He has pretty serious mental health issues. And he has really never hurt anyone. His charges are nonviolent. Essentially, Skylar was being held at a facility in Enid. It's for adults who have developmental disabilities and are acting out. It's the Robert Greer Center in Enid. And so he left that facility, or escaped, whichever verb you prefer. And in the midst of leaving, he somehow tried to steal two cars from a business, and then in the midst of that, got on a train and said he was maybe going to try to steal the train. But if you were to talk to Skylar, you would know that he does not have probably the capabilities to steal a train. And it was sort of this fantasy idea of what he could do to escape all of this. And he has a history of trying to leave places. He's always trying to kind of run from, you know, being stuck in the system somewhere.
And so he was born to, I think, a teenage mother who had, I think at that point, undiagnosed mental illness, who gave him up, but to her own mother. But mental illness was on her side of the family as well. She'd been married to someone with schizophrenia, whose
grandpa.
Father. Right. And so he came out of a difficult environment. And I think as a youngster, you wrote in the article, he really struggled to rectify, you know, how his mother abandoned him. And then he was in the public education system and did have an individual educational plan, as is required for students with different kinds of, who need accommodation for disabilities. But he was never really able to kind of make it through school.
Right. His school forgot he had an IEP. So that was a problem. For about a year, he was supposed to be on an IEP and they forgot. And he was suspended multiple times. I mean, I just don't know how you don't look at that kid and say he's crying out for help. And he had a special education teacher who I quote in the article, and she worked with him, but he was already 12 at that point, and he'd already developed some really difficult behaviors. And I used Skylar in the story, or told Skylar's story, because I just felt like he fell through every crack that existed. I mean, you know, his grandmother at one point decided she was going to press charges after Skylar stole her car for the second time, because she was really afraid he was going to hurt someone when he took someone's car, because he didn't really took her car because he didn't really know how to drive. So when the police asked, do you want to press charges, she felt like she was just out of options. And that's not the first parent I've heard who felt that way. And so, you know, that was how he got involved in the, you know, the criminal justice system, or the juvenile justice system. And from there, he just sort of bounced around facility to facility and group home to group home.
And so you were able to interview Skylar and able to ascertain that he has some goals and dreams, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, he, like anybody else, he wants a life once he leaves prison. You know, his family just worries about how doable that life is and whether the resources exist in the community to help him or whether he'll just end up going right back to, you know, the criminal justice system.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Jacqueline Cosgrove, health reporter for The Oklahoman. She is also the recipient of a Rosalind Carter Mental Health Fellowship. And she's writing a year-long series in The Oklahoman called Epidemic Ignored about the mental health system and some of the problems in the mental health system. How did you come across Skylar's story?
Someone contacted me, and you know, I can't say who. That's the fun part of my job. But someone contacted me and said, hey, look at this case. What do you think? And I was just like, wow, that is something. You know, it just really struck me that he had a nonviolent charge and also that there weren't other options. I mean, like I said, you know, there's not mental health courts in every county. And so, you know, Skylar would have been somebody that maybe if he were in Oklahoma County, he might have been selected for mental health court, but he was in Garfield County. You know, and so when I talked to the assistant DA in this case, and I briefly talked to the judge, I mean, basically everyone was like, we tried. And they did. They tried all sorts of, they sent him at 1.2 a.m. It's kind of like an assisted living facility, but it's for people with mental illnesses, and it's in Bonita. And they sent him up there, and he lasted only a few days and swallowed razor blades because Skylar is pretty self-injurious. So they tried the options they thought were available to them, but it just is not the same options that would be available if he were in Oklahoma County or Tulsa County.
Jacqueline, I wonder if you'd share with us a little bit about like how you got interested, I guess, first of all, in health reporting.
Sure. I sort of fell into it. When I started my job as health reporter, I honestly didn't know a whole lot. And about a year into my job, an editor came to me and said, you know, we'd like you to do a mental health project. And I ended up focusing on the crisis system or lack thereof. I really wanted to understand sort of what happens to adults when they're in a mental health crisis. So after I did that project, I got an email from a woman, and she was very upset for good reason because a friend of hers had recently been stabbed and died by her son. Mm-hmm. And her friend, Jean had tried really hard to get her son mental health services, but she was depending on the state system. And so, you know, there's just so many cracks in that system. And her son, Fred, he just bounced around from crisis to crisis, and he never really got consistent quality treatment. That's a term I use a lot in my reporting because I think that's important that people's treatment is not only consistent but also good. And Fred never really got that, and he was pretty resistant to treatment. He has a diagnosis of potentially schizoaffective disorder, which is a mixture of like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. So anyway, Kathleen, Jean's friend, was saying, you know, we tried really hard to help him. It was impossible to get him the help he needed. And we all knew that he was going to kill Jean. And Jean, you know, like any mother, wanted her child to be safe. And so she would do things like she slept in her car while Fred slept in the house. So that way she knew he was in a safe place, and so was she.
My goodness.
And so after I wrote that story about Jean Hardiman and her son Fred, I just got so angry because, you know, we talk about this, you know, the Oklahoma standard and how we treat each other. And I just couldn't imagine a system where a mother loved her son so much and she tried so hard to help him. And the one thing she was fighting against, her to end up hurt, Fred to end up going, you know, to prison, although he hasn't ended up in prison. He's still kind of awaiting trial because they're trying to get him competent to stand trial. She fought so hard for this all not to happen, and it still did. And that didn't make any sense to me. So that's sort of what fueled my fire, if you will.
And so in you focus like on many issues, including policy, including mm-hmm. The state health system, not just mental health, but this particular interest, was it what led you to apply for the fellowship, or was it sort of you saw the fellowship as an opportunity to support your work in doing specific focus on mental health?
Yes, absolutely. The fellowship comes with $10,000. And so that allows me to travel to other places and look at their mental health system. We just don't have the resources to do that, you know, with four reporters. And so the fellowship allowed me to do that. And I felt like that was important because when you look at other states, they are doing things that work. And some of them are not that complex to implement. And some of them don't even require that much more funding to implement. And so I just felt like we should have a conversation about solutions.
So you're a classic print reporter, but you also are really, this effort is multi-pronged. You're also doing associated podcasts with this. I mean, there's a web presence. I mean, so how do you're a relatively young reporter. I mean, how do you sort of think about the job nowadays? It's not just, you know, fedora hat and the press pass.
I mean, have a fedora.
Do you? it's a lot more than that. You have to think about all your audiences. So how do you frame that?
I mean, I think a lot about audience because I find that when people hear about these stories and they learn about the way that people suffer, I think people are very interested in human suffering and they want to understand it, but you have to kind of find them where they're at. And so that's why I've been so grateful that, you know, not only do the stories run in the Oklahoman and then also sometimes in the Tulsa World, thanks
to we see them here.
Our partnership with them, the content sharing agreement we have. You know, they also, KOSU has graciously agreed to help me do radio stories. And so that's been great because I do think that reaches a younger audience and I think it reaches a different audience, you know, and you'll have some overlap where people are just news junkies. And then I also have my newsletter because I want people to be involved in the reporting process. And when they see me saying, I went to this prison and I saw this, they can ask me some questions that can better inform my reporting. And so I like that collaborative approach with the readers. I love feedback. And then I also have my Facebook group, Oklahoma's Addiction and Mental Health Community, that has a little more than 1,500 people in it. And so and there we talk about, you know, the stories and just different issues people are facing. So I like to, you know, reach anybody who will listen, basically. And I like to try to think about how I can do that.
I think every reporter to some extent has to be able to do that nowadays, be more flexible mm-hmm. in terms of their medium of choice or, you know, be able to sort of print or provide content in multiple media. What led you to reporting? You're telling me you grew up in a small town.
Mm-hmm. Arpaler, Oklahoma. That's probably the first time it's been said on this radio station. It's about 300 people. It's 10 miles west of McAllister. Originally, I wanted to go into politics. It was when I was a teenager. And then my family told me I wasn't a good enough liar, which you can take that for what you will. But and my mom said, well, what about journalism? You know, and I had always loved to write and I liked to help people. And so I said, sure, that sounds interesting. And so I went to the McAllister News Capital and I said, hi, I'd like to intern here. I was about 16 or 17. And they said, oh, we don't have a high school internship program. And I said, hi, I'd like to intern here. And they're like, oh, this girl's not going away, is she? And so they let me work there and I had some journalists take me under their wings and it was great. I got to write a story. My first big story was The Legend of Dead Man's Lake. It was a Halloween piece, pretty hard hitting. And but I was just so grateful to get that experience. And then I went to Oklahoma State University and studied journalism and worked at the Ocali, the student newspaper there, for the 4.5 years I was in college.
And then is the Oklahoman your first reporting job out of school?
No, my first reporting job was at the Sand Springs Leader, which is not far from here, and loved reporting in Sand Springs, great people there. And then after that, I went to Oklahoma Watch, and I wrote about women in prison. And then after that, I went to the Oklahoman.
Well, so there's a thread really that runs, I mean, at least going back to Oklahoma Watch for you talking, I mean, even writing about vulnerable populations and healthcare. I mean, somebody really must have spotted that in you, you know, at an early stage to be where you are now.
No, absolutely. When I think also, like, I grew up 10 miles west of the prison, like of the max. I grew up, you know, 10 miles west of OSP in McAllister. And so I was always hearing about the prison. And I think I always kind of wondered about who was there. And yeah, in college, I had a professor who brought in a speaker, Susan Sharp. She's at OU, and she talked about women in prison. And it really just struck me in college, and I remembered that. And so when I went to Sand Springs, I thought, okay, how can I sneak this into a community newspaper? And I found some ways to do it. And then when Oklahoma Watch came along, it was just such a great opportunity. It's a great organization. And then I've just been really lucky that my editors have allowed me to take my health reporting job very broadly. You know, I've gotten to write about domestic violence and child abuse and all these different issues that are arguably health related, but, you know, I'm not writing about your typical medical topics.
Well, and that's why we wanted to have you on the program. Well, Jacqueline Cosgrove, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Congratulations on all the work you're doing and on the Rosalind Carter Mental Health Journalism Fellowship.
Yes.
We'd love to have you back on the program again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. Jacqueline Cosgrove is health reporter for The Oklahoman. Well, that's our show for today. Medical Monday on Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any shows, you can always stream them online at your smartphone or computer by going to our website, studiotulsa.org. Next week on Medical Monday, we speak with Dr. Abraham Nussbaum, author of the new book, The Finest Traditions of My Calling, One Physician's Search for the Renewal of Medicine. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.